Good afternoon. Just shy of Donald Trump's 100-day mark in office, his plans for Mexico and the rest of Latin America are anybody's guess. Trump came into office promising to build a wall to keep out what he called Mexico's murderers and rapists. He also pledged to make America great again by tearing up what he insisted was the worst trade deal in history. That seemed to spell big trouble for Mexico. After all, bilateral trade with the U.S. is equivalent to close to half of Mexico's GDP. Other countries like Brazil and Argentina initially smelled opportunity in Trump's Mexico bashing, looking for ways to strengthen trade ties with Mexico and help it make up for the coming U.S. abandonment. But 3 months into his presidency, it's looking more and more like blowing up NAFTA will go the way of so many other Trump campaign promises. And we're seeing increasing signs of moderation emanating from the White House. But it's still a guessing game. The lack of clarity from the U.S. is likely to force Latin American governments, with the exception of Mexico, to look for their economic salvation at home rather than abroad. With leaders like Brazil's Temer and Argentina's Macri in the driver's seat, that means spending cuts, privatizations, and less state intervention. Depending on who you believe, those policies will either promote a virtual cycle of low interest rates and higher investments, or increase human misery while actually staving off recovery. As for Mexico's Eduardo Peña Nieto, he must reckon with the U.S.'s unpredictability, but he must also try to squeeze more money out of Pemex and build trade bridges to China and elsewhere. Today, we're going to hear from three economists who have often voiced skepticism about the Wall Street-driven view that increased trade and fiscal austerity are a panacea for the continent's ills. Arturo O'Connell, a former member of the Argentine Central Bank's Board of Governors, has urged debtor countries to resist deals with banks that force excessive spending cuts and austerity. Fernando Cardín de Carvalho, a senior scholar at the Levy Institute, who has served as a consultant for the Brazilian Central Bank and State Development Bank, BNDES, has also argued against Michel Temer's reliance on austerity. And Arturo Huerta Gonzalez, professor of economics at Mexico's UNAM and author of 15 books on Mexico's economy, has energetically questioned Mexico's reliance on foreign trade as an instrument of growth. We'll hear from each member of our panel for the next little while, and then we'll open it up for a broader discussion about what's going on in Latin America, always a lively area. So without further ado, Professor O'Connell.
I'm a totally illiterate user of PowerPoints, but I'll try to do my best. Anyway, thank you very much for this opportunity to be with you and participate in this meeting that has been so fascinating up to now. The title, I didn't know how to best translate into English. De todos, all of us. It's very interesting that the new government, by now 15 months old, we have in Argentina, has erased the word public. And they use this of all of us. The word public is something that they don't want to use. Even the government-owned classical musical radio, for instance, the speakers used to say, this is Radio Nacional, this is the national radio. It's an Argentinian radio and a public radio. That has been erased. Now it's an Argentine radio de todos, of all of us. So that's why I insisted in initiating my talk with this. I saw this heading, Latin American policy, economic policy and new nationalism. And I wanted, just for the sake of information for many of us that might not know too much about the differences and things in Latin America, to insist that Argentina is not and quite a few other countries, it's not the same thing as other countries further to the north of Latin America. And the one thing, that's why I say Argentina idiosyncrasies. One is structural thing, like economists like to say. Another ones have to do a little bit with this new government. I mean, this structural things is that the Argentine business cycle is largely independent of the G7 real business cycle. When I read this question about the new nationalism, I mean, for Argentina, from that point of view, for Argentina, structurally, let's see then what the new government thought about it. It wasn't that important what the United States could do about protectionism. Argentina is a grain exporter mainly. Still, 2/3 of our exports are grains, which don't have a market in the United States because not only the United States is self-sufficient, but it's also an exporter of these grains, which led to 450 years to many conflict between Argentina and the United States. The quantities are weather dependent, and the prices depend on droughts, floods, things like that. Yes, on the United States exchange rate. So when I heard people from the Fed saying things about the United States exchange rate, I was quite curious. We have seen very clearly that when the dollar tends to appreciate, then commodity prices in general tend to go down, and particularly grains, food products. And then financial speculation, which is a new development in a way of the last, say, 15, 20 odd years, where investment funds have included in their basket of speculation entering and going out of commodities. So for a time, you can see prices of grains going up enormously, like soya beans at one moment in the 2006, 2007, etc. There was no dearth of soya beans at all, but it became a good place to speculate. And then in 2013, they started going down. At that time, it was, so to speak, useful because in the middle of the crisis, they kept going up, many of these commodities. So for as a grain exporter, mainly, then what happens in the United States has to do more with these financial things. In manufacturing exports, there's a proportion of manufacturing. What is important for Argentina is the Brazilian market. It's mostly, say, 80% of our manufacturing exports go to Brazil, large part of it automobiles, because the motor car industry has kind of organized the work in, at least in the southern part of South America, by doing some things in Brazil, other things in Argentina. What is important for Argentina is the financial cycle, not the real cycle. I mean, the state of the GDP in the G7, in the more advanced countries. That is very important since Argentina started opening up to financial forces, international forces in the late 70s. Plus, something that already was there but has become more and more important, a chronic tendency of Argentine citizens to place their money abroad. And so then it becomes important what happens with international finance. So additional to these things, there are the current circumstances. And the current circumstances are rather paradoxical. In this moment of nationalism, the new nationalism, these guys that came to office in December 2015, first thing, government out of meddling with economic affairs in general. B, opening the country to the world economy commercially as much as possible by signing free trade agreements. I mean, there was a moment at which, before the election, Argentina was keen on signing a free trade agreement with the United States, something that also had a story in the early 1990s. And of course, that doesn't sound like going That's why I say it's out of step comeback of the Washington consensus. I mean, these people are still thinking in those terms. Fall of Berlin Wall, liberalized capitalism is the thing, and that's it. So in this question of free trade, then they wanted to join also the Pacific agreement, which, as we all know, has collapsed, at least for the time being. So there was this thing, and the other thing was bring down inflation, which was and still is very high, through fiscal discipline and a restrictive monetary policy. So that's the background to what we are going to see, what the performance has been. It's this country that, in terms of trade, is rather autonomous of many what happens in many other countries. But from the point of view of finance, it's very much dependent on the financial cycle. So what did these new guys that came to office initiated the government? The first thing was elimination of what became so-called cepo cambiario. El cepo is something that was used by the Inquisition. It's something that it's two pieces of wood that do like that. And there were restrictions precisely to something that all Argentinians, we all love to do, which is to place our money abroad, to buy dollars and place it somewhere abroad. And there was very strong restrictions under the previous government, particularly in the last few years. There was some allowance before, but in the last few years there were enormous restrictions. The other thing was withdrawal of central bank intervention in the foreign exchange market, trying to not to have a too strong a devaluation. The other thing was settling litigation with foreign creditors. As you know, Argentina was involved in what was for a long time called the kind of the most important secular conflict between debtors and creditors, which had paralyzed precisely access to international financial markets. Paralysis that for most people in the previous government was of no interest at all. I mean, we could perfectly well handle, with some difficulty, but we could handle the situation. The other thing was elimination of taxes on export of primary products. That is also something which is pretty odd in the case of Argentina. Uruguay did something the same, which is most countries subsidize agricultural exports, you know, to sell cheaply. The European Union does it, the United States does it. Argentina, for a long, long time, placed taxes on grain exports and meat also. And then when mineral exploitation became more important in the last 10, 15 years, also on gold. Gold was precisely the most important one. And this is something very crucial, because the price of wheat or the price of maize in Argentina is equal to the international price times the exchange rate. So when you devalue, then immediately the prices of food go up. So to place those taxes is not only a very easy way to collect revenue for the state, so it's an important source of revenue, but also it's an important way to somehow delink the exchange rate from the cost of living. Because otherwise, and you hit the cost of living of those for whom food products is an important part of their budget. So this has been used for decades as a way to somewhat delink that. And the other thing was allowing increases in the rates charged by public utilities for electricity, for water, for gas, etc., that were highly subsidized. These were the first few things. As a preview of results, if I take more time than what I'm allowed to, I would say as a preview of the results of these measures that were taken right from the beginning, the recession became more serious. In fact, we had a recession in 2015. We didn't have a recession. There was small increase in GDP, but current account deficit is still with us in spite of devaluation, et cetera, et cetera. There was an increase in the amount of people sending their money abroad in non-financial sector capital outflows, which is not firms do it also, of course, but it's families that do it. Renewed external indebtedness, we will see. Inflation is still high, and it's higher, in fact, than in 2015. There's an increase in unemployment and a fall in real wages. There's an increase in poverty numbers and in inequality. There's an increase in fiscal deficit, which was one of the important things. They wanted to bring down fiscal deficit. And in the banking sector, this enormous, and banking and the foreign exchange sector, which is handled mainly by the central bank, there's deregulation, total liberalization of the exchange, foreign exchange market, but also quite serious deregulation of the banking sector. And pronouncements about inflation targeting that had never taken ground in Argentina, inflation targeting becoming the rule of the policy of the central bank, when in fact they are targeting the exchange rate as a very powerful tool to control inflation. So let's see what happened with the elimination of it, or the CEPO. I couldn't find a good word so graphic as this one in English. Elimination of the CEPO and withdrawal of the intervention led to this. There had been a small devaluation in between 2014 and 2015, still under the previous government, but there was this devaluation immediately because they eliminated any control. And there was this hunger for foreign exchange, accumulated hunger for foreign exchange. And so it was immediately 40%, then it went up to 60, and then it came down. Somebody spoke about overshooting today. That's been typical of devaluations in Argentina and in many other emerging market countries. In spite of this devaluation, the trade balance that had turned negative in 2015, the trade balance continues to be, had some reaction in 2016, that is the first full year of the government, of the new government. Well, yeah, there was some movement there, mainly because imports came down because of the recession. Also export, everything shrank, in fact. Devaluation didn't lead to an increase in the internationalization in terms of trade of the Argentine economy. The monthly returns, those were annual before, show that the trade balance, even at the beginning of 2017, right now, in the last few months, the trade balance is still more on the negative side than a positive side. Many people say that the problem was a problem of terms of trade that started falling in 2013, mainly. In spite of the crisis, as I said, terms of trade continue increasing up to 2000. There was a small fall in 2009, and then again, they went up to 2013. So that really hit also the balance of trade of Argentina. And you see the green line, which is exports, that started precisely going down in 2013. But still, and this is an argument I keep making in Argentina, still, even after the fall, terms of trade of Argentina are well above, about 30% of the era of, say, 2004 to 2007, when Argentina was generated quite huge surpluses in trade. So I say, well, yes, there was a fall in terms of trade between 2013 and 2015. There's a small recovery now. But that doesn't explain why we now have negative balance of trade or very small positive one with terms of trade that were below the ones that we have now. Still, there was a quite huge positive balance of trade. Another reason for the deterioration of the external position is something we started seeing very clearly in the 90s, which is a very high input elasticity, income input elasticity. I mean, Argentina became more and more open, and any time that GDP started going up, that was, very clear after the tequila crisis, which Argentina was hit by the tequila crisis because it had already a very high current account deficit. So people in finance said, well, what's the country that's going to be hit? Argentina running also a current account deficit of about 6% of GDP at that time. There was a recovery after that, a very fast one, and there you could see that imports went up. The recovery was 7%. The imports went up 25, 30%. And you see that, this import elasticity between 3 and 4. So every time that go up, GDP grows, we have this problem, which is a new problem. It's an old 1950s, 1960s problem all over Latin America, the famous external bottleneck about which CEPAL, ICLA, the Economic Commission for Latin America of the United Nations, used to speak and say that we had to do import substitution to cope with that phenomenon. But then in the late 60s and early 70s, that there was practically an agricultural revolution in Argentina. We had very much great increases in agricultural products, and so that started to disappear. It reappeared by the hand of financial services, because of the opening up to finance, but not in terms of trade. So this import elasticity is very high, and you can see, for instance, the motor car industry. In the 1980s, the motor car industry, a car produced in Argentina was using 40% of foreign parts. Now it's using 80% of foreign parts. And it's an important, I mean, the whole motor car industry in the previous years was generating a $10 billion deficit. Everybody spoke about our deficit in the oil industry, but there was this deficit in the motor car industry, about which there's not too much talk because publicity by the motor car industry does a lot of good for newspapers, radio stations, etc. So you won't see too much criticism of that. And also, of course, everybody loves having a car. In search of a better explanation, me and some other people, we speak about what happened with the real effective exchange rate. And you see, in those years, after the crisis we had in 2001, 2002, beginning in 2003, you see what was the level of the real multilateral effective exchange rate. Multilateral and discounting inflation. So there it was, kind of precisely the average was index at 100. And then in 2007, it starts going down, 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 and down with a recovery because of the devaluation of this new government. But it's a very important fall. We came down from 100 to 50. So that goes, I think, a lot to explain that. And in this period, from the beginning of 2015, you can see even under the previous government, inflation was eating up the exchange rate. There's the devaluation at the beginning, late December and beginning of January, and then inflation again starts eating up the exchange rate, so that it's still at the level of 55, so 45% less than in those glorious years of huge trade surpluses. So one thing is we have a balance of trade problem, to which, in addition, we have a current account problem, of course, because on top of the balance of trade deficit, there's a lot of services, what used to be called invisibles. There you have utilities, profit remittances. The Argentinian economy was very much transnationalized in the 1990s. Big firms were sold to transnational firms, and the public utilities also were sold, privatized, and were taken up by also foreign firms. So there's an accumulation. It's something you said about also the case of Brazil. Utilities being sent abroad are very important, and also tourism, because the exchange rate being low, people say, well, let's go abroad, and we buy things very cheaply abroad. So we have a current account problem. And on top of this, so the current account problem, without the CEPO, you can see now, again, there's this outflow. This is inflows and outflows. Outflows I place in red. They increase enormously under this new government. So this is not a new phenomenon. As I said, it's a chronic idea. This drain of capital outflows is important. It's in 2016, in this last year, was 50% of exports and more than 5% of GDP. So now Argentina used to be, up to 2014-15, the only emerging market country that had a positive international investment position. It had more assets abroad than debt. Debt had come down quite a lot, and there were some assets abroad. So here is, from the International Monetary Fund, the net international investment position. External debt had been reduced. That was precisely restructurings that were done in 2005 and then again in 2010, by which 92% of the creditors of public debt of Argentina accepted the restructuring that with a haircut of between 50 and 60%. But there were the group of vulture funds and other ones that kept litigating. I can't go at all into the details of what happened. This new government almost immediately came to an arrangement with the vulture, so-called vulture funds, and you can see the extraordinary amounts. For instance, NML, one of the funds of Mr. Singer, he bought a total at market value of 177 million. He ended up receiving 2.4 billion. So that's a nice bargain he did, you know? So that was one case. There's other cases. That was the most politically better known. The approximate total payments amounted to 12 billion. So Argentina issued 16 billion of new debt. Now that our friend Jess Griesa raised the injunction against Argentina, and so 12 billion was issued, and $16 billion was issued that was used to pay to the vulture funds, and that allowed this new process of indebtedness. On the whole, the Argentine government issued almost $30 billion over last year and the beginning of this year. So now, again, we have an external debt that's going up. There you can see the public debt is the blue one, and private debt is the other one. No, you can see more than 60% of the external debt is. So now I've been asked to wind up. You can see this is GDP. You can see quarter by quarter how it kept going down during 2016. There are many other figures here for other more frequent indices, manufacturing industry, construction, etc. Here's inflation. Inflation was something above 30% in 2015. Now it went up to 40% because of the impact of the devaluation and the increase in tariffs of public utilities, which was extraordinary, five times increase in public utilities. So inflation didn't stop. That was one also of their main things to bring down inflation. Inflation didn't stop. It went, in fact, it increased. And here is, you can see the case of how what happened with some of the public utilities. They increased three times. And that and inflation, of course, hit real wages. So real wages went down. And then unions, yes, this is another part of the special circumstances of Argentina. Unions are still quite strong. So they bargain, the well-organized group of workers in unions managed to recover half of what they lost. They lost about 7% of the real wage by the end of the year 2016. They managed to bring down to a 4% loss. But there have been problems of unemployment. I hope it's of real wages and employment. This is very interesting. The Catholic University in Buenos Aires has an observatory of what they call the social debt. And what you see is this red line is the unstable underemployed. This is the one that really goes up. It's marginalized people. And this is what happened with the Gini coefficients. They also calculated that. You can see in 2016 the increase in inequality. So that's what I said in my preview. What you have is a recession, you have high inflation, you have decrease in real wages, you haven't won too much competitiveness at all. I mean, because inflation has eaten up what was, so to speak, won by the devaluation. You have a decrease in real wages. Fiscal deficits also have gone up. Here you can see fiscal deficit between 2015 and 2016 went up. The primary deficit and also payments of interest went up. And Argentina has entered into this new process of indebtedness. So in the very short run, most things have been really very negative. And also a new process of huge new indebtedness is taken up. And we know this is cycles that you keep indebted yourself because this is a moment in which people want to make a fast profit. For instance, the Central Bank of Argentina that already in 2002 started issuing paper of the central bank because now nobody would, at that moment, the government was in default, and so nobody would buy a government bond. So the central bank started issuing its own bonds. And so there's a massive issuance of central bank bonds that started paying 38% per year. And they are still paying now about 24% per year. And the exchange rate for a year, it's completely stabilized. So, you know, people come and they try to do in 3 months' time or 4 months' time what they could do in 4 years' time abroad. So you, that this kind of process of speculation we have seen since the 1970s, several of them. So we don't think that the future is rosy. So thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Well, I'm taking the label "new nationalism" as an euphemism for the election. So, this is how I interpret it. And for us, actually, in Brazil, the news of the election were stunning, as it was for practically all the world. But I would say, perhaps in a provocative way, it was not the source of any particular concern. What is actually being seen and given emphasis in the press and the cautious reaction of government authorities they try to avoid is much more than the focused on two things. First, on the folklore of the campaign, the statements that were, let's say, some offbeat and political threats, like preventing the access of China to those two islands that they were, that they are building in the South China Sea, and so on. So there is some fear that, I don't know, you would like to have perhaps a more balanced person in charge of the nuclear armaments and so on. And of course, some of the phrases and things like this got to the press in Brazil, and they were surprising, to say the least. But they have not been, to tell the truth, a source of concern, especially in what respect to policy or to economic policy. They have not been taken into consideration, in part because it's not clear. It's not clear even here, but it's even less clear outside the United States exactly what it is to be expected. There were lots of phrases, and then the meaning was not exactly like that, and some threats, but then they were not threats. So some of them may be taken more seriously, like the thing about trade deals and so on. But it's still really not clear. Even what was supposed to be and potentially can be good news, like the infrastructure investment that would probably increase exports and so on from the region. But we still don't know, and it's not really clear if anybody knows, including in government and Congress, what exactly will result of $1 trillion. It's not something that you should ignore, but it doesn't seem to be the result of any actual process of decision. So far, it's rather the folklore side of it that is really being taken. It's an unusual public figure, or as Arturo would say, this unusual figura de todos, but it is... we don't really know much more about this. And perhaps more important than this is that, in last year's conference, we actually had this discussion. We have had so many problems for quite a long time now that it's not easy to see what exactly could be made worse by the eventual policies that come to be decided. And just to give an idea, I don't want to depress you with This is our GDP. These are levels. These are not rates of growth. And we can see the peak of this was in mid-2013. So our problems are, became very explicit much before anything could happen in the U.S. And in fact, they don't have much to do with the international economy. There is some discussion in terms of the deceleration of trade and so on. But certainly, Mr. Trump didn't add anything particularly important. If you, I don't know if you can see the numbers there, but from the peak in mid-2013 to the bottom there in the last quarter of 2016, GDP fell 10%. So it is not a trivial loss. This is a big, big loss. And in particular, when we, if we add the fact that it's not only our short-term problem with this 10% loss of GDP that is threatening, but this is going to give us a legacy. This is the investment rate. Again, the peak was in 2013, about 22%, which is not really a rate of a capital accumulation that would make us bet on the future. But from that time, we have this constant fall, which means that what we have is a falling share of a shrinking product. So our potential GDP, or any other name that one wants to give that would signal something about our future possibilities, are also being compromised. And there is not much insight that could suggest things are going to be, these problems are being solved quickly. Well, as I said, this is mostly of our own creation that predates any political change in the U.S. or even in 2013, nobody would predict what would happen here in 2015 or 16. So, but the fact is that we have been going through a deep recession. I'm not going to get into this discussion, but we had in last year's conference, and I think there is still a working paper that summarized that discussion. This deep recession began with a kind of stagnation that the government was implementing policies that, in theory, should be expansionary, but they were not. They just kept the level of GDP. And then, for many reasons, the previous president decided that it was the time to adopt some degree of austerity. She was impeached, and her former vice president decided to double the bet and make those choices even tougher. There are some internal political reasons for this bet that, again, we can eventually explore in the discussion. I don't want to be taking too much out of the way I planned. But those austerity policies in the midst of a situation in which growth was already decelerating and being transformed in a fall was certainly not a good decision, and the result was more or less what one would expect. When you use those policies in a decline in output, you end up with much higher fiscal deficits because revenues collapse. Tax revenues fell much more quickly. So you end up with this very strange situation in which you make some deep cuts in government expanding, and you see that you are worse than you were at the beginning, because deficits, the increase in public debt, and so on, are not only they were not reversed, actually they were made worse. This would be, by itself, a very sad story, especially for us, who used to be very optimistic and We love to sing and dance and carnival and so on. But to the economic crisis, we added something. I am in my 60s, and I follow what happened since I was a teenager, for reasons that don't matter here. But I never saw anything like this. And what is worse, nobody there can see how it will end. It's a political crisis that was rooted in this gigantic corruption scandal that seems to involve absolutely all levels of government, and actually it seems to involve everybody in government. The security guard at the door probably took some money from the construction company. And the fact is that we got to a situation in which no way out seems to be in sight. And this is particularly serious because we have general elections, presidential and for Congress, next year, and there are no candidates, actually, that are not being threatened with jail, in fact. This is what we were talking about. So whatever is happening here or in Western Europe, if Marine Le Pen wins the first ballot this Sunday and so on, is, of course, a source of concern and so on, but doesn't really make much difference in the short term, at least. And the question is, can it make an important difference in a medium term? The long term for us does not exist anyway, so we don't really waste our time with this kind of things. Well, how could, through what channels could we expect some impact of what happens here, assuming that at least some of the campaign announcements were to be followed? Well, we could see this through international trade or capital flows, our relations with the rest of the world, how vulnerable at this point we are here. So the first thing I would like to show here is this graph shows the degree of openness in the old sense, is how CEPAL, the UN organ, still calculates its exports plus imports as a share of GDP. Is the old sense, because this kind of measure were created when capital flows were not important. There were capital controls and so on. So this is not really, this is not a degree of openness. It's at most, it deals with trade. And the two lines below are Brazil and Argentina. Brazil is the gray one. Argentina is the, orange one. The blue one is Chile, which would be a small economy that would be, and so kind of doesn't have a choice. They have to be open. They depend on the provision of goods and exporting markets. And the yellow one is Mexico, which has a particular situation because of its relation with the U.S. So if at first sight, it's not that much a source of concern because foreign trade is not immediately in quantitative terms a variable that could, let's say, threaten us directly. However, as Arturo pointed out to Argentina, the same thing happens in Brazil. The income elasticity of imports grew a lot in the last 15 to 20 years because of the opening of the economy, because of the trade treaties that prevented the use of lots of the precautionary instruments that the governments had in the region. So the problem is that some very strategic imports could be affected, and this could not be seen just by an aggregate measure. So the degree of openness is relatively low for us. It's more or less is a size effect. Brazil and Argentina are big economies, have a big internal market, so it is to be expected that consumption, private investment, government, and so on would be much bigger than in a very open economy, but there is some reason to concern. On the other hand, we do have some reasons to be cautiously optimistic because it's still very early, but in the last years, we had this declining trend in terms of trade, which at the beginning of 2017 seems to be reverted. Of course, to a large part, this is because China is back. Not the whole China. China used to be 13% a year. Now it's 6.9, beating the expectations of 6.5 rate of growth. But this has been a source of relief when all the domestic demand, including government, is declining. So is it going to continue? Well, beyond hope, is very difficult to see. But this is reflected on the fact that the sectors that are growing to some extent in the last months are agriculture and mineral extraction, iron. This is what the Chinese buy. So terms of trade offer some relief, and perhaps we could also be protected against some turbulence in the international economy. But the key variable here is actually China. When China goes well, everybody dances in the streets in Brazil. When China is sad, we cry a lot. Well, capital flows have been holding. This is foreign direct investment, which is usually preferred by the authorities because it's supposed to be more stable in contrast to portfolio capital. Portfolio capital has been volatile. It responds to changes in the federal funds rate, responds to changes of practically anything one can think of. But foreign direct investment has been holding. Again, this is not share of anything. This is the amount in billion dollars. So, which is a little confusing because things are going really bad, but there is still this bet that whatever is left can be bought at good prices. The variable that, let's say, makes people feel sleep better in Brazil is the level of reserves. Reserves have been very high. It's not like China. This is not the accumulation of surplus in the trade account. This is mostly capital investment, portfolio flows, and foreign direct investment. But there is no obligation to allow the return at a fixed exchange rate. The exchange rate regime is floating exchange rates. So if there is some movement to repatriation, one alternative that is available is just allow the exchange rate to go up. And this, in fact, is one of the things that have to be considered. There is one big risk in the horizon that has not materialized this time, actually since 2007, which used to kill us. That is capital flight. And I am differentiating here capital flight from sudden stops or repatriation. It's not the financial flows of non-residents coming to the country and decided to go away. It's the residents, because we don't have any capital controls anymore. They were dismantled following the Washington Consensus and so on. So we don't have the means to stop residents in Brazil for getting the reals, the local currency, and trying to buy dollars and do what Argentinians do, as Arturo mentioned. And this is a real threat, because even those reserves that I already changed the slide would not be sufficient. So then you would have two choices, and both of them are very bad. One is to use the reserves to try to calm down, especially if you see some sign of speculative attack or something. But then, of course, each use of reserves signals weakness. So signals that next time, and then next time, and then next time, the government will be beaten. So it's a kind of paradox. You have reserves to show. You are not really supposed to use it, because then you show you can suggest that you are weak. The other possibility is to say, well, it's a floating exchange regime, At this point, the dollar costs about three reals and something, so pay six or pay eight, which, of course, I can say this here, just because this is a gathering of interested people in those problems, but a policymaker cannot do this. It's inflation, everything would really suffer very serious consequences if we had this change. So the really strategic point here, okay, I'm going to the last slide. The real point here, the thing that should perhaps concern us most is capital flight. At what point Brazilian residents decide that there is no way out, so is the time to run while you can, especially before the other people run, and this is what usually kills. So in this picture, what could the new nationalism do that could make, that could affect our situation? Of course, protectionism would affect directly. There is no, especially in some sectors in which the Brazilian economy, like orange juice, for instance, that used to be a very strong source of friction with the Florida producers and so on. So there are a lot sectors that could suffer, but not the ones, these are not the ones that are leading exports and so on. So at some point, as I said before, it's still China that matters more immediately, more than the US. Of course, you have a domestic problem that is overappreciation. Arturo elaborated a lot, and Paulo this morning about Italy and so on. I'm not going to get into this because I have less than 1 minute left. The thing that perhaps could be more affect in a more durable way was what is going to happen with the whole structure of treaties and organizations, things like the WTO and the Uruguay Round and so on. If those are denounced, what is left? And even here, there is some ambiguity, because some of those treaties are very bad for the region. They included investment in trade agreements that created some constraints on the domestic policy about foreign investments. They prohibited free trade agreements, for instance, with the US, usually includes a clause that prohibits any kind of restatement of capital controls. So on the one hand, it would be nice to be able to go back in time and perhaps this time pay attention to the documents that we were signing. But one thing, one risk is bad, is that those institutions, especially the WTO, for instance, they offer a court of arbitration. In the past, countries have to deal directly. And of course, then the differences in power are very important. The WTO, you can complain about policies from the US or Germany or whoever, and get a kind of community arbitration. And this has been used actively by, in fact, every member, including the US. So on the one hand, there is this organization for conflict solution that would be nice to keep. I think they save resources and time and so on. On the other hand, some of what we would lose would be welcome, actually, things that should not be signed. Well, what about capital flows? FDI could be affected by the America First, probably should. I don't know how many investors the president can call by phone and say, stay here, please, at any one time, but it could create a bad environment. It's still to be seen. So far, we have the more cinematographic thing of getting the phone and talk to the CEO of some place. It's not clear exactly what's going to happen. And of course, the change in the Fed interest rate policy stance has nothing to do with the new nationalism. It was expected, and I think that there is some preparation. So the point is that the main problems are still of our own creation, and we still have to find a solution, no matter it may be helped, it may be made more difficult, but by whatever happens in the international arena, but it's not really the main point. I will just finish. There is a Brazilian saying. Actually, it's not a saying. This was a Brazilian author that created this phrase some time ago, that every 15 years, Brazilians forget what happened in the last 15 years. So to some extent, this is our hope, that we can forget what was happening and begin again. And then if new nationalism is another difficulty, so be it. But it, I insist, it is still our problem, actually. Thank you.
Hi. My name is Arturo Huerta. I'm from the National University of Mexico. Mexico has been depending on the external variables. When they act in positive way, when the international price of oil is high, when exports grow, when capital inflow come to Mexico, we have a stable exchange rate. We can balance the fiscal sector, the external sector, and the economy only grow 2.4% per year. Nonetheless, when these external variables act in positive way. Now, they are acting in a negative way. International price of oil is decreasing, exports are decreasing, capital inflow is decreasing, and we don't have endogenous condition in order to stabilize the macroeconomic fundamentals. We have problem in the fiscal balance, we have a problem in the external balance. And for a lot of years, we work with our currency was appreciated because capital inflow, because the positive behavior of external variables. And in order not to lose competitiveness, our wages always had been very low. And nonetheless, the overvaluation, it was functional for the export companies, because overvaluation decreased the cost of their inputs that they come from China and Asia and the rest of Asia, and they utilize the lower cost of our workers, and then they export to United States. Highlighting the need for a change in economic policy in order how to we are going to confront this this situation. Because now, with the nationalist position of the Trump government, is going to affect our exports. The monetary policy of the Fed is affecting capital inflow to Mexico. And we have the problem that the oil revenues have been decreasing, not only because the lower international price of oil, and because with the oil reform, now the private sector participate in the oil industry, and then the oil revenues, and they need to be shared with the private sector, and then the government is going to receive less oil revenues. In these slides, what happened? The price of the the barrel was around $100 in 2011, 12, and 13, and last year it closed in average $38. And the oil exports were around $50 billion in 2011, last year only $15 billion. And then the trade deficit has increased. The oil revenue for the government has decreased too. In the past, it was 40% in 2013, 33% of total revenues of the government. last year only 16%. And then the situation has increased the trade, the fiscal deficit. Last year was lower than 2015 because the fiscal contraction is economic policy. And the exchange rate has been devaluated. It was around 13 pesos per dollar. Last year we finished with 20 pesos 61 cents per dollar. And now it's, last week it was 18.50 pesos per dollar. And today it's 19 because in the speech of Trump on yesterday. And we are going to talk about this later. And the public debt ratio has increased in 4 years, passed from 34% of the GDP to 48% in December last year. Internal and external public debt has increased in the last 4 years, and the GDP only has grown 1.7% per year. And then public debt is increasing, the economic activity doesn't grow, and in the past, the government used to adjust or to decrease the public debt and selling public enterprises. And now we don't have more public enterprises to sell. The oil reform was done, no? And the problem is how to adjust this this problem. About trade opening. And before the NAFTA, but it began in 1994, the trade opening was 25%, and last year 78.1%. And the trade of the United States in 2015 was 28%. And this situation, we have a lower productivity that our trade partners, and then we have trade deficit, we have less industry, we have more underemployment, etc. The largest commercial volume between Mexico and the United States is in vehicles, machinery, and electric machinery. Imports from the United States include oil, minerals, medical and optical instruments, and agricultural products. In 2015, Mexico trade export and imports represent, with the United States represent 46.7% of the GDP, whereas for the United States represent only 2.7% of the GDP. Export from primary sector accounted for 37% of the final demand to Mexico. In 20 years, from 1995 to 2015, exports grew 8.1%. And an important thing is how imports originated in the United States have been decreasing, and imports originated in China have increased a lot. The participation of the imports that come from the United States decreased from 74% to 47%. And imports originated in China has have increased a lot. We can see for the data from the United States, United States has a deficit with Mexico around 63 billion, but in our data, we have a trade surplus about $122 billion. But we have a trade deficit with China, $65 billion, with the rest of Asia, $54 billion, and with junior, European Union, $25 billion. So the international enterprise, I say, they import from China the rest of Asia and export to the United States. In the last years, from the crisis 2008 to 2015, exports have been growing less. And last year, only they grew 1.2%. And this, they grew agricultural mineral mining exports because the devaluation. Remuneration in the manufacturing sector represents only 4% of the value of the production. 13.7% of our workers receive up to one minimum wage. And 60% of our workers receive up to three minimum wages. And the minimum wages is $4 per day. Only 6.1% receive more than five minimum wages. 58% of the employed population is in the informal economy. They don't have stable wages, and they don't have labor rights. Yes, this is the minimum wages in pesos and in dollars. Two-thirds of manufacturing exports were concentrated in electronic products, transportation equipment industry, electric industry. 88% of the exports of computer electrics were made by maquiladoras, and the national added value was only 14%. And the, in this transportation equipment, the local added value was 32%. The maquiladora companies made up 62% of manufacturing exports, and the average of the national value added was 33%. The current account deficit has increased, and the capital account has decreased because we receive less capital inflow. Farming exports is a very big problem for us because more than 95% of vegetables go to the United States. The U.S. depends on 22% of farming imports from Mexico, 33% of agricultural imports. 60% of domestic consumption from Mexico of wheat was imported, 30% of corn, and 95% of soybeans. Farming export increased a lot in 2015 and last year because of the devaluation. And now we have a trade surplus because of the devaluation in this sector. But the devaluation doesn't act in favor of our manufacturing industry because they have a very high import component. And then the problem is how to get resources or in the surplus in the capital account in order to balance the economy, in order to balance the exchange rate. The foreign direct investment in Brazil is between $80 and $100 billion. In Mexico, no more than 28. In this case, was this because we stole Modelo industry. And they don't come because our internal market doesn't grow, and export doesn't grow like in the past. And we don't have the international trade that Brazil has. About the privatization of Pemex. Pemex was the public oil enterprise that controlled the oil production, and with the oil reform, was open to the private sector, and the government was willing to receive $70 billion, not only in order to develop the oil industry, but in order to increase international reserves, in order to finance the external sector. But they are coming to international enterprises of oil are coming in order to get the control of the fields of oil, not to invest. They are going to invest when the international price of oil could be higher.
Thank you. And we can see Pemex loss $41 billion in 2015, $14 billion last year.
and has a total debt of $96 billion. Pemex was the third largest oil producer in 2004, and now is the eighth oil producer. And nonetheless, the structural reforms in Mexico, the productive capacity hasn't increased. It's only they, with the structural reforms, we have less participation of the state and more participation of the very big international and national enterprises. With the position of Trump, with the arms sales in the border, the foreign direct investment is decreasing, and the government is promoting portfolio investment. The Mexican stock market has increased in the 3 months of this year and grew more than all the year because the expectation. The your Secretary of Commerce, Mr. Ross, he said 2 months ago, we are going to get a very good relationship in order to the review of NAFTA because we are interested to the devaluation of the peso. Because the United States lose more competitiveness with Mexico if the peso is devalued. And this situation acts in favor of the stock market and in favor of the stability of the exchange rate. But now with the position of Trump yesterday, now the stock market is around 46 in the index. We have the devaluation of the peso. About the low domestic investment. The problem is, it's the same as Brazil. They grew 2.2%. Last year decreased 1%, and the ratio of investment is 9.1%. In China is 46-45%. And then we don't have endogenous conditions in order to compete, in order to confront the external shocks. The public investment, we can see how the fiscal adjustment has decreased the public investment and is 1.8% of the GDP. And the problem is how to, the tendency is fiscal deficit and current account deficit will increase. And the government is decreasing the public spending in order to adjust the fiscal balance. And they are betting, is going to say that, free trade agreement with China and with the rest of Asia in order to counter the position of the United States. But we have a huge trade deficit with China and with the rest of Asia. We don't have any condition in order to grow with these countries. And that's the problem. So we don't have endogenous condition and we don't have the management of the economic policy in order to deal with this situation. We need capital surplus in the capital account, and we don't have more sales, asset to sales. And the foreign investor will accept pesos if you offer them profitable assets if the economy doesn't grow, if you have debt problems with a growing current account deficit, you can't guarantee payment terms with no more asset to sell. And then capital stop coming. And then the devaluation is going to continue, and the restrictionist monetary fiscal policies are going to continue. I'm finishing. about the renegotiation of NAFTA, the United States want to decrease their deficit. They want to increase the, because the aggregate value of our export, they have a lot of Chinese components. And United States, they want to increase their participation in the aggregate value of the export in Mexico. Trump has said that Mexico is winner, Mexico is loser. The country has win in all this free trade agreement has been China. For Mexico, it's better to left NAFTA and that continue what the government is betting to continue. What should the Mexican government do? How should the central bank respond to the shift of the Fed and rate policy? In December 2015, it was 3% of the interest rate, our interest rate. Now it's 6.5%. And this situation is decreasing economic activity, is increasing the insolvency problems, and instead of raising the interest rate to avoid capital outflow, they must offer profitable, productive investment options. No? Because in the past, the government used to sell enterprises in order to avoid capital outflow, no? But we don't have more assets to sell. And then my position is with protectionist economic policy, no? That the Mexican government should respond with more nationalism than the nationalists of Trump. With a protectionist economic policy in order to offer profitable productive investment, in order to avoid capital outflow and in order to receive capital inflow. In a context of uncertainty, it is needed capital control to have flexible monetary policy, in order to have fiscal flexible policy too. How the government should respond to lower oil revenues? They need to increase public spending in productive sector and to get full employment to boost economic growth and public revenue. No? Because we can do the same that European countries, to decrease public spending in order to decrease the public debt, and they don't get anything. No? In order to solve the debt problems, in order to solve the fiscal deficit, the government should increase spending in order to develop the economic growth, in order to, in the last one, face the proposal of the U.S. border adjusted tax, which will reduce export. The Mexican government should react with protectionist policy to boost domestic production. Mexico imports last year $385 billion. That is equal to 40% of our GDP. And then it represents a very huge potential to grow to the internal market. Public spending needs to generate enduring conditions to grow and to decrease trade deficit. They need to renegotiate the payment of the standard debt to get a flexible economic policy in favor of economic growth and full employment. Thank you.